From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shaft is back. This time the story revolves around the Private Eye's nephew, a cop played by Samuel Jackson. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Isaac Hayes talks about writing and performing the original theme from Shaft. And director and actor Keenan Ivory Wayans talks about making I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, a comedy inspired by Shaft and other black action films of the 70s. Also, we remember two artists who died late last week, sculptor George Siegel and painter Jacob Lawrence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Energy Department says it has found two computer hard drives containing secret information on nuclear weapons. The department said the hard drives were found inside the secured area at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, where they were reported missing earlier this week. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson said the area is being treated as a crime scene.
The FBI continues to pursue a criminal investigation. Secondly, as Secretary of Energy, I want to assure the American public that we're going to get to the bottom of the incident. We're going to hold people accountable. There's going to be disciplinary action. We must continue to improve our security so that this never happens again.
The FBI is now examining the hard drives to make sure they really are the missing devices. Lebanon is rejecting the United Nations verification that Israel has pulled its armed forces out of southern Lebanon. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan confirmed that Israel has withdrawn from Lebanon according to the requirements of a 1978 Security Council resolution. The move opens the way for UN peacekeepers in Lebanon to redeploy at the Lebanese-Israeli border. But Lebanon's Prime Minister Salim El-Haas is disputing UN claims that Israeli forces have completely pulled out from the area. He maintains they're still occupying several positions inside Lebanese territory. Meanwhile, the UN chief wants adequate Lebanese forces to be deployed to southern Lebanon, where Iranian-backed Hezbollah guerrillas are filling the vacuum since the Israeli pullout. The UN peacekeeping force already in Lebanon will be enlarged in July to help Lebanon restore its authority in the south. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
Federal regulators have approved a $60 billion merger between Bell Atlantic and GTE. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Approval by the Federal Communications Commission brings to an end a two-year review process. That's how long it's been since the two phone companies first announced plans to merge. At a time of growing competition in the phone business, it's likely rivals will go to court in an effort to block the deal. Gene Kemmelman with the group Consumers Union says his group is also against the merger.
Truly lost an opportunity to have a dramatic explosion in competition. Instead, we have mergers of enormous companies that are just getting more enormous.
The combined company will have a huge national footprint, providing service to 63 million customers in more than 30 states. It will have a wireless presence that covers 90% of the country. The new company, Verizon Communications, will be significantly bigger than its nearest competitor, SBC, which last year merged with Ameritech. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost 265 points, or 2.5%, today to close at 10,449. This is NPR News. Some of the people who were forced out of their homes by a Colorado wildfire were allowed to return today, and others were told they'll be able to go home by the weekend. Cool, damp weather helped firefighters who were trying to contain two big fires near Denver. The Federal Commission on Civil Rights today accused the New York City Police Department of improperly using racial profiling. Carrie Nolan with member station WNYC reports.
Reviewing the NYPD's policy of stop and frisk, the commission said the tactic contributes to an atmosphere of fear and mistrust, exacerbating racial tensions that could lead to what it called, quote, tragic and unnecessary incidents. According to the commission's findings, blacks and Hispanics are disproportionately stopped and searched. For example, on Staten Island, 51% of stop and frisks were done on blacks, who only account for 9% of the population. The report also called into question police department training and recruitment of black and Hispanic officers and recommends creation of an independent office to investigate accusations of wrongly used deadly force. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani did not immediately respond to the report, but in a rebuttal to an earlier draft, city officials called the commission's findings shoddy. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan in New York.
Police in Montenegro say they've captured the gunmen who shot and wounded Serbian opposition leader Vuk Drašković last night. A Montenegrin spokesman said police were holding the gunmen and those who assisted them. He said Montenegrin officials also know who ordered the attack. Drašković, who leads Serbia's largest opposition party, accused Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic of ordering what he said was an attempted assassination. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from UUNet, the business side of the Internet, offering Internet communication solutions to business customers worldwide. Information at uu.net.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Remember me? Read my mind. Who delivers 10 times out of 10?
Who's the cat that won't cop out?
Jay Ray. I might take you down, but I'll never let you down. Now, what's my name?
Shaft!
You're damn right.
Shaft is back in theaters. This time the story revolves around John Shaft's nephew, a cop played by Samuel L. Jackson. Richard Roundtree returns as Uncle John Shaft, and the famous theme music is back too. The original 1971 film Shaft was the first of the studio-produced blaxploitation films. It starred Roundtree as a private eye looking for the kidnapped daughter of a Harlem gang lord. The theme launched a new sound in action movie music and won a 1972 Academy Award for the composer and singer Isaac Hayes.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks?
You're damn right.
The man that would risk his neck for his brother, man. Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about?
Right on. You see, this cat Shaft is a bad mother.
Such a mother.
What I'm talking about, Shaft?
Well, we can do it.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Shaft.
Isaac Hayes went on to star in a couple of action films. In the 60s, he helped shape the sound of Memphis soul music as a songwriter, arranger, and producer and singer for Stax Records. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. Now he's the voice of the school cafeteria chef on South Park. I spoke with Isaac Hayes in 1994 about writing the theme for Shaft.
When it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl, and you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, what can I do? I thought about, if you remember Otis Redding's Trial of Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal, you know, you got the na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. He started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know. And he did that, and it worked.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks?
You're damn right.
Now, there's something I've been hoping to be able to play for you for a long time, and I'm just thrilled I have the opportunity to do it now. I want to play this record for you, and tell me, I figure you've probably heard it, and you could tell me what you think of it. So let's hear an excerpt, and then we'll talk about it.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. Black private eye, whose mastermind has got him what he wanted. Shaft. Shaft is the man.
Isaac Hayes, you recognize the recording?
Yeah. I produced that on Sammy Davis.
Did you really? You produced it? Yeah. That's Sammy Davis. Yeah. No, what did you think of Sammy Davis doing Shaft?
Well, I mean, I was thrilled, you know. I mean, you know, Sam and I were friends, and he wanted to do it, you know. And in fact, the night that we were in the studio doing that, it was the Golden Globe Awards. And I had no idea I would win, so Lou Gossett received the award in my stead. And I was in the studio with Sammy. Oh, wow.
It just seemed, you know, it's just really funny it's so out of character for him. I mean, he was going through this real kind of groovy period, I guess.
Yeah. You know Sammy, you know, he was into what was happening now, which is good. You know, he rolled with the trends.
I want to spend a couple of minutes talking with you about how you developed your image. When did you start shaving your head?
I started shaving my head not long after I got out of high school.
It wasn't fashionable then.
No, it wasn't.
To my knowledge. It was... So what inspired you to do it?
Well, you know, during those times as musicians, it was a fad. We had a relax in our hair. Called it a conk process. And during that time, mine was cut very low and just slicked down on my head all the way around like a coconut, you know. And it was hip. It was a style. But in the summertime, it was hard to keep up. And you sweat and it come undone and you had to sleep with a stocking cap on, all that kind of stuff. I said, I'm sick of fooling with this stuff. I'm going to cut it off. So I went to the barbershop around the corner from Stacks. I said, Mr. King, cut it all off. What? Cut it all off. I'm going to grow a new crop. And when he cut it off, you know, I went outside, you know, and I said, wow, it's a breeze out here. It feels great. I can feel the wind on my head. Hey, I think I'll keep it like this. I already had the beard. And people would look at me and say, oh, wow, oh, look at this guy, man. He's got ball in the beard. But I didn't care because it was different. I like being different. You know, I like swimming upstream. And a funny thing, one time, Booker T, by some era, had somebody book two dates on the same day for Booker T and MGs. And one date was in, I think Booker had to go to Oklahoma somewhere. And I went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania with Al, Duck, and Steve. And David Porter was a vocalist. And I was to pretend to be Booker T. And I'm at the organ. We kicked off the tune, kicked off Green Onions, you know, and grooving. Somebody said, hey, man, ain't no Booker T. He ain't got no hair. And, I mean, they were ready to riot. I jumped up from the organ and got out there with David, started dancing and singing and doing everything, trying to appease the people, you know. But finally, they said, well, okay, what the hell, we'll accept him. And I mean, I played the entire gig. And, of course, years later, I went back as Isaac Hayes, and I played Harrisburg, and I told that incident, and some people remembered it, and they cracked up.
That's funny.
But, I mean, I was an unknown, but I just looked different. I liked a different look.
Are you still doing it?
Oh, yeah. You see, the thing about it is, it's ageless. So when I go naturally, no one will know.
Isaac Hayes recorded in 1994. Coming up on this archive edition, Keenan Ivory weigh-ins on his satire of blaxploitation films. This is Fresh Air. Actor and director Keenan Ivory Wayans is one of the filmmakers who grew up watching Shaft and the other black action films of the 70s. Before Wayans created the TV comedy series In Living Color, he paid tribute to the blaxploitation era with his satire I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. He wrote, directed, and starred in this comedy about a young man who returns home from the army to find his brother is dead.
Mom, exactly how did Junebug die? Mom...
She's really taking this pretty hard.
Well, is somebody gonna tell me what's going on?
Jack, not too long after you left, Junebug started hanging out with a bad crowd. I mean, he even started selling drugs, Jack. And then things really got bad when he...
Well, what?
He started wearing gold chains, Jack.
Oh, God, no.
It started out as just one or two. And it seemed like every time he'd get some money, he'd go and buy more gold chains. But he was wearing hundreds of them, Jack, hundreds.
Not gold.
Yes, Jack, gold chains and medallions and rings and even his teeth, Jack. You can't imagine what it was like to kiss him. He took a picture just before he died. We put it on the mantle.
Junebug! How do you go to the bathroom with all this stuff on?
I spoke with Keenan Ivory Wayans in 1989 about his film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
The basic story is about a character named Jack Spade, who is played by myself, who comes home from the army after 10 years and finds out his brother's been killed from an overdose of gold chains. And he decides to do something about it, and he rounds up all of his old heroes, and they go after Mr. Big, who's a big gold distributor in town.
I thought of this as an homage as much as it was a parody. I figured you must have seen a lot of the black exploitation films.
It was exactly that. I lived on those movies. They were, and that was what we did on the weekends. We went down to the theaters with a couple of dollars and saw like three movies and spent the day. So I got a chance to see all those films in their heyday.
One of the retired heroes who gets back into the action after your character says, "Help me find Mr. Big." This character says, "The people said I should retire, that I was too violent, that I was a bad image for the kids." Do you think that that's the rap that black exploitation films got, and do you think that that rap was deserved?
Well, that's the film that is the rap that they got. No, I don't think that it was the rap that they deserved. I think that the term became a blanket term, and it was used to describe almost every film that had a black cast. And what you have in any genre of film is good and bad. An example is horror. You have Alfred Hitchcock, which is classic, and then you have Friday the 13th, Part 80, which is basically a formula picture that's slapped together with no real creative integrity, designed to exploit an existing audience. And the same thing happened with films that depicted black life. They had the good ones and they had the bad ones. Shaft is not an exploitation movie. Shaft, as a matter of fact, was a monumental film. I mean, if you look at it, it was the first time a black man had been in a lead that displayed him with any aggression or any sexuality. Secondly, it was the first time that a black director had ever directed a major motion picture for a studio. That was Gordon Parks and MGM. It was also the first time that a black had ever won an Oscar for a score of a film, Isaac Hayes. So That was a great accomplishment. And when we look back, Shaft will be classified as an exploitation movie.
So you think in the attempt to get more positive role models, the opposite happened. There were no blacks on the screen for a long time.
Yeah, I think in the attempt to eliminate the negative, everybody overreacted. And as a result, abandoned the group of films that we had out there that represented us in a very good fashion.
Well, in your film, your character approaches all these former action heroes and brings them out of retirement. You literally did that to make the movie.
to some degree, you went to
Isaac Hayes and to Jim Brown and to Bernie Casey and asked them to be in your movie. And I was wondering what kind of reactions you got from all of them, telling them that you were going to do this part parody, part homage to the movies that they were in.
Well, everybody who's in the film came on with the same enthusiasm about the movie that I had. They all thought it was funny and all looked at it as a chance to have fun making fun of themselves. there were those that I approached that didn't find it funny.
When you were taking the screenplay around trying to get money to get it produced and everything, were there any suggestions that in order to really make back the money, you'd need to draw in a white audience, too? In order to get a white audience, there'd have to be more white characters or a white sidekick or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the suggestions was to have Anthony Michael Hall play my stepbrother and have him act black the entire film. And my response was, I have 60 real black people in the movie. Why have him in there acting black, you know?
Keenan Ivory and Wayans recorded in 1989. By now, you're probably wondering how the new film Shaft compares with the original. We have a review by our guest film critic, Henry Sheehan.
Not a remake or even a sequel to the independently made landmark blaxploitation picture of 1971, the new Shaft, starring Samuel L. Jackson, is all Hollywood. Jackson doesn't even play the maverick black private eye created by Richard Roundtree in the original two sequels and a short-lived TV series. That Shaft lived on society's worn edges, working out of a cruddy office in a definitely pre-urban renewal Times Square. He kept his home in Greenwich Village and chose his friends from the demimonde. And when the law didn't fit, he broke it. Jackson's John Shaft is that Shaft's namesake and nephew, an elite kick-ass detective on the New York City police force. This Shaft may be related by blood to Roundtree's character, but in movie terms, he is far closer to two other gun-toting Avengers from the 70s, Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry and Burt Reynolds' cynical homicide detective from Hustle. We get a faceful of Shaft's attitude right from the start. The detective turns up at an upscale Manhattan nightery where a clean-cut black youth has just been beaten to death. The chief suspect is rich kid Walter Wade, played by Christian Bale using some of his leftover malice from American Psycho. Leaning on his social status, Wade sneers at Shaft, daring him to prove his guilt.
How'd you get that blood on yourself?
Blood, what blood?
I'm going to ask you again. If you give me attitude this time, I'm going to drag you out of here by your hair. How did you get that blood on yourself?
It was late. He started it. And I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I was razzing the guy. He couldn't take a joke.
Oh, so you cracked his head open. Yeah, I can dig it.
I'd fall him out to apologize. Next thing I know, he's coming at me with a silver bat. I was defending myself.
Anybody see?
No, officer. It's just me and him out there. You know who my father is?
No. Do you?
Through some literally unbelievable coincidences and contrivances, Wade manages to stay free for a couple of years. Until one day, Shaft arrests him just after the detective has also busted a Dominican drug dealer. Wade and the dealer, Peoples Hernandez, end up in the same holding cell where they quickly start to plot against their mutual foe, Shaft. From that point on, it's mostly gunplay and chases, with a little bit of backstabbing and betrayal thrown in for good measure. These action scenes are uniformly good, slick Hollywood production set pieces that combine hardware and flesh and bone in fine, crumpled form. The movie ends with a car chase that's shorter and briefer, but more down, dirty, and entertaining than anything in the overblown Gone in 60 Seconds. But in a larger sense, the film never gets its ideas in order. It's full of half-digested notions and discarded and suddenly reclaimed characters. This could be because of the reported rift between, on the one hand, director John Singleton and his chosen writer, Shane Salerno, and, on the other, producer Scott Rudin and his preferred writer, novelist Richard Price. But more likely, the movie's problems are due to its discomfort over race. The original Shaft had to work outside the law because it didn't protect black people. This new Shaft has no such problem. Singleton goes out of his way to make two new points in the movie. One is that the NYPD is full of black officers now, so its racial makeup is not an issue. The one racist commander we see in the movie is retired. The second is that Shaft's larger mission isn't to protect his fellow African Americans, but to look after the middle class that they've joined. In one otherwise unnecessary scene, a woman agrees to help Shaft after he agrees to beat up the street corner drug dealer who has been pestering her son. Both the woman and the dealer are black, a clear sign that ethnic solidarity takes a backseat to class unity. This is a far cry from the 1971 film. Then, Shaft agreed to work for a black drug dealer for the longer-term goal of keeping the peace in Harlem. And that Shaft only had a touchy relationship with the white NYPD. But for one group to be in, at least as far as Singleton seems concerned, another group has to be out. With African Americans joining whites and filling out the ranks of law enforcement, the criminal world has developed a Spanish accent. The African American actor Jeffrey Wright, who starred in Basquiat, plays the Dominica gangster Peoples with the kind of low, lisping cunning used by Mexican bambitos in old westerns. Throughout the movie, the original Shaft, once again played by Roundtree, turns up to urge his nephew to quit the force and go into the family private eye business. But in American movies, at least, private eyes need a personal moral code to live by, not merely a set of police regulations to rebel against. For Roundtree's Shaft, that moral code protected him from the cold isolation of society's margins. But Jackson's Shaft sits warmly on the inside and guards the door against his uncle's old allies.
Henry Sheehan is the film critic for the Orange County Register. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Off the Mangrove Coast by Louis L'Amour, a new collection of adventure tales. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember two artists who died late last week. George Siegel, who made life-size plaster cast sculptures of people in everyday poses, and painter Jacob Lawrence, who has been described as the premier painter of the Black American experience.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sculptor George Siegel died last Friday at the age of 75. New York Times art critic Roberta Smith wrote, "George Siegel's rough-surfaced casts of actual people brought a new, often eerie realism to post-war sculpture and made him one of the most quietly influential artists of his time." Siegel made his life-size plaster figures by wrapping his friends, family, and other models in plaster bandages. He insisted that his models remain in casual poses so that he could make believable art. He often placed his plaster cast figures in larger sculptures that recreated real environments, like a butcher shop, a dry cleaner, a diner, or a bus. Many of Siegel's plaster cast people have a ghostly presence because he left the white plaster unpainted. The curator of a recent retrospective wrote, "By sensing the miraculous in the everyday, Siegel hints at a metaphysical transcendence." In 1998, I asked Siegel to describe the style of casting he developed.
By using this plaster of Paris bandage in thin layers, I'd have a model stand or sit or lie according to some idea or image I had in my head, and I'd cover their bodies in small chunks and then have to reassemble them to recreate the gesture. And I was more interested in the gesture or the essence of the movement as it was revealed by how they stood or sat.
So you'd use the same kind of material that a doctor would use who was making a cast for a broken arm?
Exactly. Exactly.
And so you would do like an arm and then another arm and then a leg and then the torso and then assemble the whole thing together.
Yeah, remember Dr. Goldfinger? They killed the girl by painting her with gold paint.
Right. Yeah. So, you didn't want to be in that position.
It's embarrassing.
Did you make any mistakes before you knew what you could get away with?
Sure did. I got some free samples of the stuff, and I was offered $75 to write a pamphlet for using material for children's projects. I had my wife cover me from head to foot, and I was nude sitting in a chair. It was hot summertime. I had no idea that plaster sticks to hair, and it did.
Ouch.
My wife couldn't get it off.
What'd you finally do?
I stood up and I tore it off. It was like taking a giant Band-Aid, a very large Band-Aid off your body. But I was so intrigued, I put it all together, despite the sadomasochism involved.
So did your models have to shave before?
No. I discovered things like Vaseline that solved the problem.
Well, how would you get the kind of pose you were looking for? How would you even find the right model for the piece that you were going to do? Say it's a piece of, you know, like a diner at the counter of a restaurant, or, you know, the lady in the dry cleaning store.
I honestly can't tell you where the ideas come from. While I'm walking city streets, I can see something that will strike me, if it makes a vivid image in my head, I'll have to work a long time rebuilding that chunk of it that intrigued me. So I started using family and friends, you know, people whom I could convince that I was not going to kill. people who would trust the fact that I would, hopefully, I'm not a sex maniac, and could be reassured that I would not take advantage of them while I was waiting for plaster to dry. Simple stuff like that. It had to be people who essentially trusted the seriousness of my intentions.
Now, the standard way of casting in art is to make a mold and then pour a liquid material or a molten material into the mold that will then harden in the shape of the model.
True.
But that's not what you're doing. You weren't using the plaster cast as a mold to pour
the liquid into, you were using that as for its outside, for its surface qualities, which isn't traditionally what's done with a plaster cast mold. Tell me why you decided to use the outside as opposed to using the inside to cast.
I was interested, as I said before, in trapping the gesture. And in recent years, I have been using the inside of the cast. But that's, well, the euphemism is I'm becoming aware of my middle age. If I look at my fingers or I look at my face in a mirror, I'm horrified. I'm horrified at the wrinkling of the skin that gets more and more pronounced every month. And then I'm intrigued at the rhythm of this increasing network, both on my face and my hands. And I start looking, all right, it's called middle age. And I'm not a kid anymore, and everybody in my generation is aging in their own fashion. And I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued with how we change, what the aging process is, and how it affects our thinking and our attitudes toward everything we know.
So how are you trying to capture that in your art? Because the kind of plaster cast that you did early on wouldn't, for instance, get the wrinkles on the face.
Say I make the same plaster cast. If I turn it over and look at the inside, there's a reproduction of all those wrinkles that intrigue me so deeply. And I simply put some separator in there, pour plaster into it, or the same bandages, and I can make a cast that's quite realistic. You know, so, you know, realism is a very strange term. It's incredibly simple technically to make a cast that's increasingly realistic. The only reason I continue to cast from people is the uncanny ability of the plaster to reveal inner attitudes, what attitudes my models have. Otherwise, I'd been bored years ago and have completely dropped it.
When you say inner attitudes, you mean that, like, the body, the bones of a body just reveal things about a person that the plaster can capture?
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah. For myself, it's quite vivid.
I want to get back to the work that you're doing now. You were saying how both horrified and fascinated you are with the wrinkles on your face and the wrinkles on the faces of your friends and family of your generation. Mm-hmm. You've also been doing, I think they're charcoal sketches of of people, returning to your early work. I mean, you used to be a painter before you were a sculptor. Is that the reason why you've been returning to a two-dimensional form, to sketching, so that you can capture those facial details?
Absolutely true. These new drawings are about my fascination with heads and faces and hands. I've been using that euphemism, I'm middle-aging. Oh, for heaven's sakes, I'm 73. I had drawn a lot years ago. I had stopped drawing once I started getting very involved in making sculptured environments. Now, I'm making oversized heads, drawings of heads, that into which I can dig. And again, you know, it's this hunger to embrace all these contradictions. I want to make them as abstract as I can in structure. I want them to be psychologically truthful in revealing the attitudes of my friends. I'm simply trying to hack out and embrace of all these contradictory factors that I'd like to put together to indicate 3 minutes of experience.
Are you particularly interested in how your face is changing with age and the faces of the people who you know best, how their faces are changing too? Because it's just like inflicted on you. I mean, it's not about anything that you're doing. It's just, you know, changes of age, and it just happens. You wake up and you look different than you did 2 weeks before, maybe. Does that have anything to do with it? That sense that it's just kind of happening to you? You're being acted upon by some force of nature?
Some force of nature?
No, do you know what I mean, though? It's out of your control.
Strange you should say that. That's the essence of what we're talking about, I think.
Because you didn't used to be that interested in faces. I mean, there really weren't facial details in your plaster sculptures. And
quite so.
And certainly you didn't do, like, intimate self-portraits of yourself earlier on, to my knowledge.
Again, quite true.
So how does it feel to you at this stage of your career in your 70s to start doing more realistic self-portraits?
Depends on your definition of realism. Very strange. How do I say it? When Jackson Pollock first started throwing paint, he was accused by people who were disturbed by the lack of resemblance to nature, the real world, in the paintings. And Pollock, stood erectly and insisted, "I am nature." And I burst out laughing when I heard that remark, and I had this instant vision in my head that I was standing behind Pollock while he was throwing paint. He was wearing suntan pants for some reason. Maybe it has to do with the Gap, I don't know. But he was not wearing a shirt. And while he was throwing paint, I was watching the muscles on his back and his arms working. I need that kind of realism. I also need the realism of what's going on in your head. How does an artist make concrete all that invisible stuff that all of us have inside our heads? And what one artist will call realism, another someone else will call the essence of an idea.
We'll hear more of our interview with sculptor George Siegel after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with artist George Siegel. He died last Friday. You grew up, let me see if I have this straight. You were born in the Bronx and then moved to New Jersey, where your father bought a chicken farm?
Yeah, yeah. And you say that with a question mark.
Right, I want to make sure I'm right about this.
Yeah, yeah.
So your father had a chicken farm in New Jersey, and the butcher shop that he had came before or after the chicken farm?
A butcher shop came before.
Came before the chicken farm.
Yeah, my father assured me, he said, "You'll never make a living as an artist." At the time, he said it was true. And people always have to eat. And the crowning irony was I started going bankrupt on my own chicken farm. I learned chicken farming from my father. I studied art in school, but I did listen to the extent where I majored in art education. I got that degree that allowed me to teach. started going bankrupt on my chickens and started selling my art.
Although you abandoned the chicken farming, you kept the farm, I believe, and turned the chicken coops into your studios.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
So your chicken farm must be filled with very rich memories.
It's also filled with sculpture. Some sculpture, it's sculpture I couldn't sell, and some sculpture I insisted on keeping. But I won't tell you which is which.
Fair enough. And I think you also used your chicken farm as a site for one of the early happenings in the late 50s, one organized by your friend Alan Caprow.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What was that like? What was the happening like?
Caprow lived down the road from me, about 2 miles away, and we live in the country. He found a farmer who brought 4 tons of hay in bales that was stacked on a piece of bare ground. He wanted to rent a bulldozer to face an army of grown people and children armed with sticks from the woods. And first time in my life I ever censored an art event. I said, "Had you ever driven a bulldozer before?" He said, "No." And I said, "If your foot slips, we have some dead people." So he got a row of cars to battle the army of people and sticks. It was like that. Lucinda Childs and Yvonne Rainer danced on the roof. Lamont Young and his wife Marion played on their instruments. It was intensely interesting.
Who had to clean up afterwards?
Everybody did their own cleanup. It was remarkable. You know, the art world was very small, and about 400 people were there, and everybody picked up after themselves. It was quite astonishing. Listen, the art world, when it began in those years, was the last refuge for idealists.
What have you been able to use from your knowledge of chicken farming and apply to your art? Anything?
Well, I used to hate the chickens. They were cannibals and they were vicious with each other, but I love the building. I learned plumbing, carpentry, electricity, cement work. I learned all those things building my own place, which stands me in good stead as a sculptor.
Do you eat much chicken now?
Only when I'm forced.
Really? You had it with chickens a long time ago.
For reasons I don't understand, my wife still loves to eat them. I love to avoid them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
George Siegel recorded in 1998. He died last Friday at the age of 75. Coming up, we remember painter Jacob Lawrence, who also died last Friday. This is Fresh Air. Painter Jacob Lawrence died last Friday at the age of 82 after a long illness. Lawrence has been described as the premier painter of the Black American experience. He celebrated the energy of Harlem street life pictured the hanging of African Americans in the South, paid homage to celebrated leaders like Harriet Tubman, and painted portraits of the uncelebrated, such as cabinet makers and shoeshine boys. Lawrence came of age in Harlem in the 1930s at the tail end of the Harlem Renaissance. He was part of the artistic community that was nurtured by the New Deal employment project, the WPA. He became one of the first African-American artists to be represented by a New York gallery. He first gained recognition for a series of paintings called The Migration of the Negro, which showed scenes of the Great Migration North by Southern African-Americans. I spoke with Jacob Lawrence in 1988 and asked him about the inspiration behind the Migration series.
Part of my years was spent in Philadelphia up until the time I was about 13. My parents probably were a part of that migration, moving up from the South, moving to eastern Pennsylvania, then to Philadelphia, then on to New York. When I was in Philadelphia, I used to hear people talking, the older people in the community. Well, they would say, well, somebody, another family has just come up. And they would bring them old clothes and things and get them started. So this became a part of my, it wasn't conscious at the time, but I heard this so much.
A lot of your paintings tell stories, the stories of the black migration from the South to the North, the story of Harriet Tubman, the story of Frederick Douglass. Are these stories that you knew had been kind of omitted from the official history of the time? Is that part of the reason why you wanted to tell them?
No, I wanted to tell them for their drama, for the humanitarian concern. They were very dramatic for me. No, I didn't do it out of saying, well, these have been, because I must have gotten them from somewhere. That was the Chambre. I didn't know to what degree they had been omitted or anything, but I did them out of sheer drama and out of being able to relate to the content. That was my purpose for doing them.
There's a series of paintings of Harlem that you did in the early 1940s.
43, yeah.
And one of the paintings, I think it's called Harlem, is almost like an aerial view of a few blocks.
Panorama, yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you see houses, you see people on the street, and you see signs that say dance, bar, beauty shop, funeral home. I like that painting very much, and I'm kind of wondering where you set yourself up to paint it and why you chose that view.
I didn't paint it direct from the scene. It's my expression, again, of my environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess these were the things that you one would does see in that painting are symbols of what I would see every day, the beauty shop, the pool parlor, the funeral home. This is very common visually. I didn't have to go looking for it. It was all around me. So I decided, and the rooftops were very important. As they were true in New York City generally, you go through many older paintings by the early paintings by American artists, and you see fire, if they're dealing with a certain genre, you see fire escapes and the rooftops, the East River. You see, well, the Harlem community was a part of New York City, although it had its own particular symbols too.
You said the rooftops were important. How were they important in your neighborhood?
Well, the kids would play on them. They would run up and down. They had pigeon roost on them. Sometimes people would go up and hang clothes, or they would sleep on them during the summer, hot summer months. They were just as important as a fire escape, you know. They would, and the areaways, and they were important in that way.
One of the things I really love about your paintings is the colors that you use. Very, very bright colors, a lot of primary colors.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's so much action in most of the paintings and so much movement, there ends up being a lot of color and a lot of rhythm in the way that the color is used. Can I ask if there were any influences on you in your use of color?
I would say yes. I would say my people of my parents' economic level of situation. They were very poor, of course, lived in tenements. And I think because of a reaction to this, they decorated their homes in many, many bright colors and things. And I think it was a reaction, again, to the times. I would say that. And so, therefore, it started in the home and spread throughout the community. So the entire community had this decorative became very decorative. And I think that might have been made a great, subconsciously, a great impression on me. And I use this in my, this is a way I had of developing my work.
Did you see paintings when you were young that made you want to paint?
Well, there were people in the Harlem community who were painters. So I would see their paintings. And the period in which we were brought up in, the 30s, was a period it was in the Great Depression. As a result of that, the administration, the Roosevelt administration at that time, set up various arts centers throughout the country, which enabled youngsters like myself to have this kind of exposure into the arts, music, dance, theater, the visual arts.
Since 1971, you've lived in Seattle, Washington, mm-hmm. where you've been teaching at the University of Washington. How has your paintings changed since moving from the East Coast to the West Coast, from New York to Seattle?
In content, they have not changed. But in form, I think that not a change, but a discovery of light, space. I would say that, because if you go from a teeming eastern city or some other city, and here you go to the far west where everything is completely open or relative to a relative degree, and you get this variety of space and tonal color that I hadn't experienced in the east before. And as a result, I find myself using this element more and more, the element of tonal color.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Artist Jacob Lawrence recorded in 1988. He died last Friday at the age of 82. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From eTapestry.com, creator of web-based fundraising software for managing the donor information of large, medium, and small nonprofits. eTapestry.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Great Escape with Chickens. We talk about the new clay animation film Chicken Run with its directors Nick Park and Peter Lord. Nick Park also created the Wallace and Gromit animated films. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.